Hey, so good afternoon, everyone. So in the next 25 minutes or so, I will be describing how to perform efficiently small writes with no updates to file systems while preserving good layout for serial reads. The idea in a nutshell basically stems in having a large write buffer or stage area and then scheduling random writes to disk so that we can retire between 6 to 8 IOs in a single resolution. And this is work done in collaboration with my colleagues, Sandeep Shette, who's somewhere in the audience, and Keith Smith over here at the Advanced Technology Group at NetApp. So it turns out that there's an important type of workload in data centers that a few file systems or storage systems have trouble with. Namely, it's a workload of serial reads after random writes. The writes are essentially small logical updates to data. And the serial reads come from reading the data that is being continuously changed by those logical updates. One example of such workload is database systems. They acquire data by putting transactions and changing records in a page or something like that. And then they want to do data scans for some business intelligence applications or in sort of OLAP environments. And there are many other examples. For example, virtualized data centers, we see similar kind of workload for VMDK or virtual machine disk images, et cetera. And the other sort of issue is that we are really looking at the data center scale. So obviously, when we talk about small IOs, SSDs is a favored technology to use it. But at that scale, using SSDs only is prohibitively expensive. And it turns out that our customers still use mostly disk drives. So we really want to sort of look at how can we make that disk drive that turns out to be the most expensive part of a storage system, even today, how to make it more efficient. So if you look at current storage systems, they basically make a trade-off in their design space. They optimize for one prevalent access pattern, and that's either the serial reads or random updates, but they're not really good for both of these together. If you look at update-in-place writes, for example, in a fast file system or EXT2 in Linux, they preserve locality by for serial reads. So when we do a serial read with the update-in-place, that's okay. However, these updates are really inefficient, especially when we talk about data stored on priority RAID. The other extreme, or the other sort of end of the design space, is LFS-style lookup and writes. It's great for taking small writes and coalescing them into large IOs. However, when that happens over time, the layout on disk gets fragmented, and the serial reads are not doing very well. So what we really want is a file system where both the random writes and serial reads are efficient. And that's sort of what we set out to do with this work. So here's our approach in a one-slide or one-minute summary. Basically, what we do is we stage random updates in a non-volatile memory buffer. At some point in time, we destage or bulk write allocate those data to disk. And then we use a concept that we call proximal I/O that makes this destaging or bulk write allocating efficient. And it turns out, as I will show you in a few slides, that you can actually retire effectively multiple IOs in a single disk resolution. In our approach, we chose a write allocation with no overrides, because it turns out that our product derives a lot of good value from old data, whether it's snapshots, back in time travel, etc. And because of that, of the new approach to write allocation, we maintain a good serial read efficiency for aged file systems. So when you kind of is said and done, what we have is a performance from our system with a RAID 1-like penalty for updates, which obviously is very simple because you just mirror. And what we observe is a minimal degradation for serial reads on aged file system. So that's for the introduction or brief outline of what we're doing is, and for the rest of the talk, I will give you some overview of some of the concepts behind the work, show you some results from our prototype, and have a few concluding remarks at the end. So before I tell you more about the proximal I/O concept, let's sort of look at disk technology trends. Although they are changing quite rapidly, these days what you can do is you can take a random seek that takes about 9 milliseconds on a classic sort of a high-capacity kneeline drive, SATA drive, and then you can read in a single revolution the entire track. So that's about a megabyte of data, give or take. Or what you can do is, after that random seek, you can selectively choose between 6 to 8 IOs that span a range of about 100,000 blocks. And you can also read them or access them in a single revolution. And that's what we're really after. And sort of this sort of a flexibility that you have in this range of today 100,000 LBNs or so, or blocks, comes from the fact that normally when you think of a seek, you think of a sort of a moving a disk head from to adjacent track. However, because there is the head switch time and the giving the density of the error density, we can really choose any of the roughly 100 tracks and still pay the penalty of the minimal head switch time or minimal seek. So that gives us really the large freedom of choosing among those 100,000 blocks for either writing or for reading. So let me show you in the cartoon what we really mean by proximal I/O. Obviously, at the storage system or file system, we don't see the details or the layout of individual sectors. So we choose at random eight logical blocks or eight blocks in the span of 100,000 sectors. Well, on this disk, that 100,000 blocks correspond to a swath of about 100 tracks or so. And then because we have no really visibility where those logical blocks fall, they're a random location from our perspective. And so our choice of random eight locations fell on these sort of axes on our rotating media. So because of the sort of minimal head switch time, we divide the entire circle of the disk into wedges or bins, which are whose width is really dictated by the speed with which we can change tracks. So obviously, the faster we can move the head around from track to track, the more bins we have. So in our example, or with the current technology, we have roughly 8 to 10 bins for a 7200 RPM disk drive. So given that sort of a binning and sort of the randomly chosen location of those blocks, obviously we would like to service them in one revolution, because that's the best theoretical sort of case we can do. Well, it turns out that for our choice, there's a couple bins where we have more than one request, if you will. So for this particular choice of blocks, we have to schedule them into revolutions. But it turns out that probabilistically, we can service somewhere between 6 to 8 requests in a given revolution, depending obviously where we land. Sometimes we miss, but not very often, as it turns out. So how do we achieve the density, right? If you look at current drive, we have a 1 terabyte disk, we have 250,000 blocks, and I talked about a span of only about 100K or so locations. So obviously, we need to get this mismatch or 5 orders of magnitude difference. And what we do is we take non-volatile memory and we buffer or stage enough data so that we actually achieve the density. Well, obviously, that would be a little buffer because it's the 5 orders of magnitude difference. But there are a couple of trends that work in our favor. Number one, in a storage array, not every single I/O that goes to disk is actually user-generated. There's some metadata I/Os, there's some other sort of stuff that goes on the background that I will describe. And second, that a workload isn't really purely random. So we don't have a uniform distribution of requests across the entire drive. There's some areas or some data that are hotter than others, so we can sort of play with that locality. And so it turns out, as I will show you with some results later on, that all we need is roughly about a stage area that's corresponding to 1% of the total size of the working set. So if the working set hits on a very small portion of the disk, then the staging area is small. If you have a truly random workload and the working set touches every single block on that disk, then obviously you're talking about 1% of the total disk space. So let's kind of crawl back from the bottom of the disk drive and sectors and scheduling, et cetera, and let's sort of look at the big picture of really what we are after in our system. In the traditional approach, we have a RAM-based buffer cache where we put our dirty data. At some point, some process, in the case of BSD, a BD flush thread, comes around and says, I need to write those dirty buffers to the disk. So it's going to pick them up from the buffer cache, put them down to the disk queue, and then the disk firmware is going to reorganize the schedule of these requests to minimize the service time. So that's really out of the control of the OS, and the disk vendors and the firmware know best how to do that. Well, even though you have this sort of request reordering and scheduling, it turns out that the distance typically the distance between those blocks is really too large to leverage the proximal I/O. So we have to have a couple of revolutions and some random seeks in between to service these, in this picture, 3 requests. So in our approach, what we do is we just make that staging area bigger, and we hold more data. Obviously, we need to make it non-volatile because we are holding much more data in flight. So when we accumulate enough data, we have the option of choosing selectively appropriate blocks that leverage our proximal I/O. So in this picture, we are going to choose three blocks that belong to one file, extent, or object. And then we are going to write allocate them near each other so that we are fitting within that 100 or so tracks or the 100K sectors. And again, we don't care how they are really going to the media because the disk is going to reorder the schedule, but they all fit within that 100 tracks or so. So that's sort of pictorially how our approach works. Let me tell you a little bit more about some features or details that I think is pretty cool before I go to the results. So first, we take small overwrites and we absorb them into flash memory. That's our implementation today. But unlike sort of a write cache or buffer, we really update the metadata for the file system immediately so that the NVRAM or the flash memory in our implementation really is the rightful place, at least for a while, for the data. And so if a request comes to data while the data is still in the NVRAM, it's going to be serviced from there. So that the same holds for a set of sequential reads or serial reads. When we read data from the media, from the disk, we can stream at sort of the full bandwidth speed. But obviously, there's some old versions of the data that are high in the stream. So we replace those data with the current versions in the flash memory in our case. And it turns out that works pretty well because obviously we are streaming most of the data from the disk. That's what it's good for. And then the flash memory, the random reads are much faster than accessing them from the disk. So we are actually OK. And the second point I want to make is about the destaging. That is, the activity when we take those logically related data and then we put them out to the disk. Well, because we process them in batch and we select data that belong to the same logical construct, extent or object or file, we get some reuse of accessing the data. Obviously, we need to read the metadata, such as indirect blocks and bitmaps, et cetera. But because of the decisions that we make during write allocation, we can access them multiple times and make decisions without having to read metadata over and over again when we refine our write allocation. So let's look at some of the results from our setup. So we built a prototype of a file system data layout engine. Essentially, it's a stripped-down object store, if you want to think of it that way. It stores extents, so variable size logical constructs. And then we have basic operations like create, read, write on those extents. And we implement the basic allocation algorithms that I described earlier. So that's the destaging and putting things nearby already existing locations on the disk. For our platform, obviously, we chose a NetApp shelf of disks with 1 terabyte SATA drives. And we use a flash-based SSD as our staging area. In our prototype, we also use a user-level emulator of the NetApp implementation of the RAID layer. And there's sort of one interesting point about that before I move on to the results. It turns out that most storage systems, including ours, have some additional information for every 4K block, say. So we call that checksum or context info. So what that means is when the file system asks for 4K of data, it really asks for 4K of data plus some additional set of bytes. So obviously, when you look at a SATA drive, we don't have a flexibility of using custom-sized sectors. So we need to put that checksum info or the context info somewhere else. So for assume we have a 4K sector, we need to collocate the information for some number of blocks, data blocks, into an additional block. So what we end up having is a layout where for every n data blocks, we have a checksum 4K block that includes all this info for the n minus 1 blocks before that. So I'm looking at a basic workload of sequentially writing large extents, or medium size, really. It's not that large, 60 megabytes. And we are going to be doing lots of random updates to them. So that will sort of provide the aging of our initial good sequential layout of our system. And then, obviously, as we do this aging, we will be doing the destaging of data from the NVRAM or from the flash memory, in our case, to disk. And we are looking at a case where we have a 90% full file system. So for those of you who have played with file systems, you know that allocators are not so effective when you have mostly full disk. And what we are interested in is looking at the effect of changing the staging area with respect to the working set, or in our case, the size of the disk drive. So intuitively, the more staging area you have, the more flexibility we have in choosing the right request, so, and the better off we should be in sort of doing more efficient writes. So here's pictorially how our layout looks on our system. So after the initial sort of write-out of large extents, we have flash memory on the top, and that includes metadata information. And then we have, in this picture, 7 different extents depicted by different color, and they are nicely sequentially on the system. Now, when we age the file system, the picture looks a bit different. You see that we have some holes, sort of looks like a cheese, but still, if you squint, you can still sort of make out the individual extents at the disk. And obviously, if you look at the flash memory on the top, you see that there are sort of individual blocks that are in the staging area, if you will, that haven't quite made it yet to the disk. So that will be at some point B stage when this flash memory becomes full, and then put into these sort of nearby locations or plug in the holes in the layout on the disk. So let's look at sort of the result of doing first small random updates. So let's look at a baseline case, or the write-in-place sort of a RAID priority RAID implementation. And I take a user write. So a single user write, turns out, is sort of serviced in our experiment in 16.5 milliseconds. So I should say that we have a 4 plus 1 RAID 4 with the sort of typical SATA disk drives. Now, if you look at our approach, when we in this case use a 1% of the stage area relative to the working set size, we can batch on average 47.5 user level IOs in a single D stage operation. And so, if you do the math, it turns out that we actually have a service time of 2.7 milliseconds per user write. So that's about 6 times improvement or decrease from the effective service time on the typical write-in-place priority RAID implementation. And now let's look at some of the more derived metrics that sort of are interesting, because typically our backend and the disk subsystem is resource limited. So we look at first IOs per revolution. So in the baseline, we can service 2 IOs per revolution. So remember, we have RAID 4 or priority RAID, so we need to read, modify, write. And also, I talked about those checksum blocks. So for every user write, we have to access the checksum block. And for those, we have to do read, modify, write, so both on the disk, data disk and the priority disk. So we have an amplification of 8x, meaning that for every user IO, we generate 8 IOs at the back end for those data disks and priority disk. Now, in our case, what we have is effectively 5.3 IOs per revolution. Well, actually, that's what we measured. And still, because we still have to do read, modify, write, and we still have to do reading the checksum and modifying the checksum blocks, we have amplification of about 6.2x. So we haven't really shaved off any actual IOs from the back end, but we are able to do it much more efficiently. We can do on average 5.3 IOs compared to the 2. And so we get that's where the benefit really comes from. So now let's look at the serial reads after those random writes that we looked at before. In the new file system, we get effectively a 89 megabytes per second per disk bandwidth. And obviously, when the layout is new, everything is nice and sequential, we can do it in sort of a very few IOs to the RAID layer. And obviously, because of striping and other issues, we generate some number of IOs per disk. Now, in the H file system case, so you remember that picture that had sort of the holes in the layout, we get an effective bandwidth of that's only 3% worse than the best case scenario. And obviously, because of the age layout, we have to issue more IOs to the RAID subsystem, and obviously we get more IOs per disk at the back end. But the key is, even though the layout is really aged, we only get a 3% degradation. Now, compare it to sort of the LFS style write allocation, and for this case, just to prove my point, I chose a system where we don't do segment cleaning or we don't do any reorganization. Obviously, if you age that system, you get a really bad performance. You have 97% degradation, and obviously that comes from the fact that I have to go all over the disk to fetch the data, and obviously have many more IOs to service the same logically large prefetch or read request. So that's sort of some basic numbers to give you a feel for what we can get. And the more important question is, how much flash is enough, or how much should we buy for our system? Because as we all know, flash is expensive, so we want to kind of make sure that we don't waste our money when someone uses the system. So in this graph, what I'm showing is on the x-axis, the increase of the flash size relative to the working set or the disk drive size, right? So it's percentages, so the thing on the left is 1%, to all the way up to 12. So, and on the y-axis, I'm looking at two different metrics. The one I talked about before, the IOs per revolution, and the disk IOs relative to the user IOs, what we call the IO amplification. So that's the y-axis for those metrics because they're just numbers. So I circled there the number that you saw on that table two slides ago, and that's sort of respectively the 5.3 IOs per revolution and the 6.2x IO amplification. So as you increase the staging area, as I said before, intuitively, you are doing, you're better off. You have more IOs per revolution, that's the green line, so we are going up. And obviously, we are being more efficient by coalescing some of the requests, and we are decreasing the IO amplification. But if you kind of look at it, there's really a sort of a point of diminishing returns. So if you look at a value of 3% of staging area relative to disk size, you don't really get much of a benefit. And so if you go keep going, you kind of oscillate, right? So obviously, there's no point of having 10 times as much flash because you really get a very little benefit compared to the 1% case. So let me summarize the talk with a few remarks. So first of all, we use flash memory as a staging buffer, right? So this is not really about flash or cache hierarchy. This is just a tool for our purpose of staging or putting those dirty data somewhere in the system before we put them out on the disk. We destage when we have sufficient density of IOs for that effective proximal IO range of data. And a result that we don't really talk about here, but we show in the paper, for a system that has equivalent cost of having only disks, so I buy more spindles, versus a system that has some amount of flash memory, we can get three times as many IOPS for the same cost. So really, if you flip it around, for a one-third of the cost, we get equal number of IOs by buying flash memory. And obviously, the trick that we use to make those destaged IOs efficient was to use the proximal IO. And what we get in return, as I said before, is read-run-like performance on a priority rate system. And the other thing that sort of is a point for, maybe a fine point for the file system meanies in the audience, is that we eliminate the need for the background grooming or segment cleaning, if you will, in the LFS style. What we do instead is we really do the in-band reallocation during the destage. So remember, the destage really is an asynchronous operation from the user IOs. But what it buys us is that we have a bounded amount of extra work per operation, as opposed to in the segment cleaning where when you run out of space, you have to sort of suspend everything and then groom or collect data from partially deallocated segments. And that can be unbounded because it depends on the workload, obviously. So before I yield the floor for questions, just two more points. One of them, please talk to us. We will be at the poster. Keith is here. Sandeep is somewhere in the audience. I haven't seen him. You can contact us with email. And the other thing that I want to mention is that I was told that we are hiring. So if you want to talk about job, talk to us as well. All right. Thank you.
Ajay Gulati, VMware. So it seems to me there are two different ideas. One, you say that you use a bigger staging area, and second, you do proximal I/O. I was just wondering how much of the benefit comes from the staging area size versus the proximal I/O.
So in a nutshell, we are really looking how little of the staging area do we need in order to get those 6 to 8 IOs per revolution, right? So yes, we need that, but if you remember a few slides back, if you were doing it blindly, we would need, we have a five orders of magnitude difference between the number of blocks on the disk versus the effective range of proximal IO. However, we only need 1%, which is 2 orders of magnitude difference, in order to get that efficiency from the proximal IO. So you're right, we get, obviously we need that buffer, we need the staging area, but we need a lot less of it than what would sort of come out of it if you were just doing compare the size of the stage area versus the size of the number of the disk, if you will, right? So we really are looking at it as leveraging the flash technology or the staging area to do the proximal I/O and looking what do we need in resources in that flash memory in order to get to that required density of 6 to 8 IOs in a span of 100,000 blocks or so.
Okay, thanks.
Wang Guabao from Ample. When the staging area is full and before the destaging finish, when new writes come, where do they go? Where do you put the new writes if the staging area is full?
Well, you know, there's obviously you do some sort of tricks like double buffering, or so you know you don't wait until you hit the you fill out the last block. So maybe I should mention what we do is we kind of do a up and only kind of a start to staging area. So obviously there's some buffer, and you know those are kind of the details that we have to worry about if you want to put in a product. But obviously you know those are there's no secrets, right? You have to worry about it in the system. So yes, there's some buffer. If you want to be really simplistic, you can do double buffering, but you know obviously that would be wasteful. So the usual approach is we don't do this stage and wait until we use the last free block in that flash memory and then do this stage. That would turn asynchronous writes into synchronous ones.
Hi, Nitin Parab from Riverbed. Maybe this is a repeat of the first question. Mm-hmm. How do you compare this to your previous work on free block scheduling? Is it free block scheduling where the staging area is size zero?
That's a good question. The difference here really is that in the free block is I would claim that the staging area really was the entire set of blocks that you haven't touched yet, right? So I would reverse it, right? I would say it's the number of because you have no choice. You have to kind of quote unquote buffer all the data that you haven't touched yet with the free block schedule. I apologize if I'm talking the context. You know, Nitin and I go way back, so maybe it's to that. But essentially, the trick is here that we have a very limited view, right? We have that 1% or what of the data that we stage. In the free block thing, we have a choice that's much, much bigger, right? So, for example, if I have touched only 1% of the disk, I have imaginary staging area of 99% of the blocks that I can choose from, right? But again, it's a very different application. Here we are obviously governed what the application wants, what the stream of user small updates are based on application needs. Whereas in the free block, we look for applications that don't have this constraint and kind of you know virus scan and things like that. So I would say it's not the zero buffer size. I would say it's the other way around. It's everything that wasn't picked up yet by free blocks.
Ayesh Gupta, Penn State. Since you are using Flash for performing the random mm-hmm. writes, have you looked at the ramifications of the low lifetime, which
of what?
The lifetime issues of Flash because you're performing random writes and you want to tightly provision Flash for reducing the cost?
Good point. Maybe I didn't make it clear. The writes are random from the perspective of the application. But really, it's up and only style of writes, right? So we are essentially a block one from application comes in, a block 35 comes in, but it really sits next to it. So if you can think of it that the staging area is sort of has a log organization, right? So we do up and block after block. When we reach some sort of a threshold or when it's full in concept, modulo the point of the previous question, we kind of you know pick them up with random reads. But really, we are writing to Flash in sequence, because in the sequence of arrival, you know, time sequence of arrival of those random updates. So that's the key.
Yeah, but since you will be reading them randomly, right? Mm-hmm. So the invalidations on Flash may make the garbage collection which happens on Flash quite ineffective, which can have the lifetime ramifications later on.
Yeah, but again, so it, sort of the practicalities notwithstanding, you can think of it that we write allocate the Flash upon to the end, then we randomly pick up the ones that we want to put because of the
exactly. That's the point.
But then we say okay, we can delete the entire content. Again, if you imagine double buffering, you can think of half of the Flash is doing this, writing things in sequence. The other half is in the meantime absorbing the writes from the client. Right. So again, we don't do double buffering because that would be wasteful. But in that sort of a example, that's what you do. You are destaging by picking things at random and then dropping the entire half of the buffer, if you will, while you are collecting the, from that point on, random updates into the other half of the buffer. Again, I'm using this illustrative example of double buffering.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. All right.